So if you need a Bible, raise your hand and we'll place a Bible in your hand. We're going to be in what I would say a chapter that wouldn't be one that I would believe anybody would say, hey, if I'm going to teach at a conference, man, can I do Genesis 36? I don't know if that's ever happened. In the history of the world, of all the conferences that a pastor gets to encourage with other believers or whatever, they go, oh, can I do Genesis 36? Well, we are going to do Genesis 36. Hold on to your hats. God is good. And we will see some exciting things here in Genesis 36. But before we get there, we have to finish up 35. Okay, we have to finish up 35. And so last week we left off with the death of Rachel in Genesis 35, 21. And Rachel died on the road to Bethlehem, but she did not die in Bethlehem. Scripture makes it very clear, 1 Samuel 7, 1 Samuel 10, Jeremiah 31, that the exact location was in Ramah. That's where she is buried. She's buried in Ramah in the land, later on to be the territory of Benjamin. And so that's kind of where we left off last time. And so let's begin with verse 22. And it happened when Israel dwelt in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. Ooh. And then, boom, that just happens. And you just go, what is that all about? Besides just being gross and disgusting, what is this all about? Well, I think there's more to it than just that dastardly deed that has been mentioned here. We do know that if a son wanted to usurp the authority of a king, he would sleep with his father's concubines to claim lordship over the family or kingdom. Near Eastern culture held that the possession of the concubine of a man's father or a vanquished enemy meant validated succession to that authority. We see that in 2 Samuel chapter 3. We see that with Abner, the commander of Saul's army. After Saul dies, we're told that Abner went and had sex with one of Saul's concubines to strengthen himself in order to hand over the kingdom to David, to be able to come to David and said, I have the authority to do that. And so he indeed does that with David, makes a covenant with him, and he actually hands over the kingdom to David. We also see this with Absalom, David's son. When David runs ran out of Jerusalem there, and he's run out of his own kingdom, it's Absalom, his son, that has an advisor by the name of Ahithophel. And Ahithophel tells Absalom to take David's concubine to show the nation you are now the new king. Here in this slide in 2 Samuel 16, 20, it says, then Absalom said to Ahithophel, give advice is what we should do. And Ahithophel said to Absalom, go into your father's concubines, whom he has left to keep the house, and all Israel will hear that you are abhorred by your father. Then the hands of all who are with you will be strong. So they pitched a tent for Absalom on top of the house, and Absalom went into his father's concubines in the sight of all Israel. Now, we also know that it is quite possible that Reuben himself, it might not have had anything to do with that. It could be the fact that Reuben has been angry at Jacob all these years because he played favorites with Rachel over his mother, Leah. Well, Rachel is now dead. And is it possible that Rachel's maidservant will now become David's favorite wife? And so by sleeping with Bilhah, Reuben defiles Bilhah, and now Jacob can no longer sleep with her. And she would have been given the status of living widowhood. This is also what happened with David's concubines. When David came back to Jerusalem after Absalom died, we read this in 2 Samuel 20. Now David came to his house at Jerusalem, and the king took the 10 women, his concubines, whom he had left to keep the house, and put them in seclusion and supported them, but did not go into them, so they were shut up to the day of their death, living in widowhood. It could be now that he has slept with Bilhah. Guess what? She's now going to be living in widowhood. Yes, Jacob is going to take care of her, but he's not going to sleep with her anymore. Whatever the reason Reuben did this despicable thing, it's going to result in him losing his inheritance of the firstborn. We read in Genesis 49, verses 3 and 4, when Jacob is blessing his children, he withholds a blessing for Reuben. In verse 3, it says, "Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity and the excellency of power, unstable as water. You shall not excel because you went up to your father's bed, then you defiled it. He went up to my couch." I would also imagine that the sons of Bilhah, Dan and Naphtali, are pretty miffed at him, pretty upset with him. And I don't think that went away after a few months. And so, again, what Reuben created here, this division now within his family, not good, not good at all. And then we have the summary of the 12 sons. Now, the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, Zebulun. The sons of Rachel, Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali. The sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. And these were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram. Is that true? Were these sons born to him in Padan Aram? Benjamin wasn't. Yeah, he's included in that. Benjamin died on the road there to Bethlehem. He's in the promised land when he was born. So why does it say that these were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram? Well, I would submit to you that it has a lot to do with grammar. Padan Aram. I want you to see this in the Hebrew. So in the Hebrew, you have Padan Aram. But when you put the letter bet in front of the word, like we have here, you have in. It becomes a preposition, in Padan Aram. The problem that we see here is this preposition in, okay? Does in always mean in? Well, it does if it's supposed to be in. But does bet, the actual letter before the word, always mean in? No, it does not. No, it does not. From Brown Driver and Briggs Lexicon, we're able to see here that the word bait here, which I think is coming up here. Yep. Here in this text could mean in, or it could mean through, or it could mean by means of, or on account of. So now when you read it, these are the sons of Jacob who were born to him by means of Padan Aram, or an account of Padan Aram. In other words, by means of Jacob going down to Padan Aram, he was given these sons. It was by going down there that he acquired those wives in order to have these sons. It's always good to know a little bit of Hebrew. Always good to know a little bit of Greek. It's always good to actually have a program that I could just go to and go, oh, look at that. And you could do that as well. I'm no Hebrew scholar or Greek scholar. I just happen to know where I can go to look some of these things up. And so praise God for that, because it makes things a whole lot easier. You'll notice of Leah's sons, they all kind of turned out rather badly. We have Reuben. He sleeps with his father's maidservant, Bilhah. We just read about that. You have Simeon and Levi, who did that atrocity in chapter 34 of killing the whole town of Shechem, all the men. And then we're going to see Judah sin later in chapter 38, but we see all the sins of Leah and Bilhah and Zilpah and all their kids in chapter 37 as they take Joseph, throw him in a pit, and they sell him off as a slave. The interesting thing to me is that when it comes to Rachel's children, Joseph and Benjamin, the Bible does not mention any bad thing they've ever done. please don't think they were the perfect children. There have never been such besides Jesus himself. Okay, these two were also born little balls of sin, okay, as we all have been. Then verse 27, then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre, or Kirjath Arba, which is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had dwelt. So it would seem that Jacob and his family came down to live with Isaac for a while in this place. Just know verse 27 and 28, there could be 12 years in between there. It could be a dozen years, 10 years, 5 years, few years, okay, between verses 27 and 28, all right? We're trying to encapsulate, kind of put an end cap to Isaac and his life so we can continue to move on now with Jacob and now Joseph, all right? So this is just kind of a summary of putting an end to Isaac's life. And so here he moves down there to be with Isaac, all right? And it could be that, as we discussed last time, Deborah, all of a sudden we just see Deborah show up in the account here of Jacob's life when he's there at Bethel. We don't know when Deborah came. We don't know if she came when he was in Shechem and was part of that move up to Bethel. You know, we don't know as soon as he got to Bethel, that's when she arrived. All we know is that Deborah is there under his care, and we read that she dies. Well, who's Deborah? Deborah is the maidservant to Rebekah, his mother. And for her, Deborah, to be with Jacob, that tells us his mother has died. Now, could that have kind of prompted in his heart to leave, to go down? Man, I've wasted all this time. I never got to see my mother again before she died. Isaac, my father's still alive, but I don't know how much longer he has. Maybe I need to go and see him before he dies. And maybe Deborah kind of stirred that in him. And so whatever the reason, he now goes down there to Hebron to be with his father, Isaac. And we don't know how much time that was, how many years that was. But I would submit to you it's probably several years, okay? Several years. As a matter of fact, I would even submit to you that possibly, you know, before we get to verse 28 here, that chapter 37 actually happened during the time between 27 and 28. That Isaac could have been there when Jacob gets the news that his son Joseph has died at the hands or at the paws of an animal. Okay, that whole mishap when he was actually sold off as a slave, but his brothers deceived their dad into thinking that he was killed by a wild animal. Isaac could have been around at that time. We don't know. We don't know. But what we do know is here in chapter 35, there seems to be a wanting to, let's just kind of put a cap on Isaac's life as we go into chapter 36, which is going to talk about Esau and his descendants. So now we can start fresh in chapter 37 to talk about the next major player in the book of Genesis, and that's going to be Joseph. That's going to be Joseph. So verse 28, now the days of Isaac were 180 years, so he was 180 years old when he died. So Isaac breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days, and Esau and his sons Esau and Jacob buried him. So here we have Esau and Jacob together. I would submit to you they probably, once he moved down there, they're in the same area as we're going to see here in a moment, okay? They're in that area of Hebron. They were both there. I would submit to you they probably have talked some things out and things like that. But they are here to bury Isaac. And so the place of Abraham's burial is not given here, or I should say Isaac's burial is not given here. Man, I'm having a hard time between those two. It's good that we're putting an end to those guys so I can continue on. But we're given it in Genesis 49, okay? When Jacob is about to die and gives a charge of where he wants to be buried. In Genesis 49, verse 29, it says, then he charged them and said to them, I am to be gathered to my people, bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. And in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought with the field of Ephron the Hittite as a possession for a burial place, there they were buried Abraham, Sarah, his wife. There they buried Isaac and Rebekah, his wife. And there I buried Leah, is what Jacob would say. And so Abraham and Rebekah are buried there at the cave of Machpelah. That's also where Isaac and Rebekah are buried. And that is also where Leah is buried. And that's where Jacob's going to want to be buried. And we'll get to that when we get to chapter 49. So verses 27 and 29, it's just a quick summary of events. And again, I submit to you that chapter 37 could have taken place there between verses 27 and 28. And so here it seems like the story of Abraham has ended. The story of Isaac has ended. This storyline of Jacob continues with the addition of another main character, Joseph. Since chapter 12, all the way through the rest of Genesis, we're going to have four main characters. That's Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and Joseph. You have the first 11 chapters with all those things that happened there. But these last, 39 chapters deal with these guys. And so now we're going to come to chapter 36 before we continue with this amazing nation that God is building out of these 12 tribes. We have to give kind of a summation of that other guy, Esau, and kind of what happened to him and what came from him before we go on that main topic of now these 12 tribes and what became of them. And so here in chapter 36, verse 1, it says, now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom. Right out of the gate, they want everybody to understand that the Edomites came from who? Esau. Esau. The reason why you have the Edomites, that's what became of Esau. Okay, that's what became of Esau. So Esau's genealogy is going to be seen first in the land of Canaan, and then those outside the land in Mount Seir. We'll see that here in a moment. So in verse 2, it says, Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan, Adah, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite. And then you have Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth. So the interesting thing about this is that we've read about Esau's wives before in Genesis 26 and 28. The difference is they had different names. These are different names than the names that are given in chapter 26 and chapter 28. Chapter 26 says, when Esau was 40 years old, he took as wives Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite. Well, we didn't see a Judith when we just read. And Basemath, the daughter of Elon the Hittite. Well, we read about that, but it was with a different woman that is called Basemath now. So Esau, chapter 28, verse 9, Esau went to Ishmael, took Mahalath, the daughter of Ishmael, Abraham's son, the sister of Nebajoth, to be his wife in addition to the wives he had. So this next slide here shows in chapter 26 and 28 what they were first called, and now what they're being called now. Interesting. Why? I don't know. And nobody seems to know. Okay? I mean, I could look at this and see that Judith here, we know that names are changed for a variety of reasons, that maybe some great exploit has happened in some person's life or something wonderful has happened or they've done something, and hey, we're going to change your name to this. So that could be the reason for the name change here, okay? We know that people are given more than one name. And so now instead of going with this name, they're now going with this name, okay? So we do know that there's reasons for it. The reasons aren't really given, so I've kind of, in my own mind, kind of looked at things, maybe thought maybe possibly this is it. But the word Judith here is Yehodith, and it means praise. It's a feminine form of Judah, okay? Now, you figure that when Esau went and got this wife who is a Hittite, introducing her to mom and dad, let's not go with Aholibamah, all right? which means a tent of high place, which speaks of idolatry. Let's go with a different name. Let's go with praise. Judith, that maybe, you know, that means praise of the one true God, and maybe they'll be more accepting of you. I have no idea. I have no idea whatsoever. And then when he goes back now to Mount Seir, and when he goes back to that place, now all of a sudden you can have your name back, which means tent of the high place, because they do idol worshiping there. I don't know. I don't know. And nobody else seems to know either. It's a very interesting thing. You have here basmath or bosmath means spice or fragrance. And then her name is changed to Adah, means ornament. Both cool names for a woman. Just want to say, you ever want to name your kid Adah? Means ornament. How awesome is that? Or bosmath means spice or fragrance. Don't know. So why do you change your name? You know, I don't know, because that other wife wants the name Basmath, because that seems to be the situation here. You have Machalet, means stringed instrument. I don't know, maybe she's high strung. And so let's get rid of that name. And let's now bring your name to mean, you know, Bosmath, meaning spice or fragrance. I don't know. But they've been changed. They've been changed. And we're not told why. We're not told why, but they have been. So there's a reason. I don't think that we're privy to it. Okay. But like I said before, names change all the time in the Bible. You see Naomi saying, call me Mara now. You know, you see Abram now, Abraham. And so you have Simon who's now, you know, Peter. And so, you know, names do change for the whatever reasons there are. So here we continue on to verses 4 and 5, and it focuses on the sons of Esau who were born in the land of Canaan. Okay. Now, Adah bore Eliphaz to Esau, and Basmath bore Reuel, and Aholibamah bore Yush, Yalam, and Korah. These were the sons of Esau who were born to him in the land of Canaan. So Adah bore two sons in the land, and Aholibamah bore three sons in the land, for a total of five sons in the land of Canaan. So at this point, Esau and his family were living in the land of Canaan. Okay, in the land of Canaan. Verse 6. Then Esau took his wives, his sons, his daughters, and all the persons of his household, his cattle, all his animals, all his goods, which he had gained in the land of Canaan, and went to a country away from the presence of his brother Jacob. So Esau ceded the land to Jacob. Esau took the patriarchal blessing seriously, decided he had to find his own possession away from the land of Canaan. Why did he leave? Verse 7, for their possessions were too great for them to dwell together, and the land where they were strangers could not support them because of their livestock. This is the exact same reason that Abraham and Lot had to separate. There was contention over the wells and all this grazing land and things like that. But yet the land of Canaan is huge. There's plenty of room for both Jacob and Esau. But the issue here is the area that they were living in there in Hebron. Hebron is a city-state, okay? And that city-state has neutral land around it, a great swath of neutral land that other people were on and things like that. And it is in that land, in that area, that they've grown too big that they both can't be on it anymore, okay? They can't be on it. And so each town had a holding a very large area of land around it, and the actual neutral land was not very big, and the neutral land around Hebron is not enough for them anymore at this point. They've outgrown it, so they can't sustain them both. So Esau moves to a place that we'll see here in a moment is Mount Seir, okay? So take note of this. Esau is the one who walks away from the promised land. He's the one that walks away from the promised land. He's the one that walks away from the covenant blessing that God has given. No one forces him out. And again, by walking away, it shows that Jacob is the one that has right to the promised land. So Esau dwelt in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. Begins with that, ends with that. Want to make it very clear. The Edomites, they came from Esau. Esau. And so here's the new land that Esau is going to settle, Mount Seir. Now, all the descendants would become Edomites. And you know that when we first saw Esau and Jacob being born, that we've gone over that, that he's described as red and hairy. And it doesn't just say hairy, it says hairy as a garment. That means furry. And as I mentioned, I believe that's God's first reference of a Muppet, okay? And just so you know, it continues in this direction. Because Edom, Adam, means red, and Seir means shaggy, hairy. It continues on. It's not named after him. Seir is the originator of the Horites. So he's going to a land that seems to be, well, like him. There is a guy named Seir, and he is hairy and shaggy as well. And I can only imagine Esau coming to the land going, my lost brother, who also looks like Bigfoot. He's looking like Bigfoot or, you know, a Muppet or whatever. And boom, they hit it off in a sense, you know. But he's going to a place that's called Hairy and Shaggy. It's probably a Scooby-Doo reference in there as well. But, you know, when they met each other. And so it says in verse 9, and this is the genealogy of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. In other words, this is what became of Esau and his descendants. These five sons were born in the land of Canaan, but now they grow up in Mount Seir, and they get married. They have sons of their own, so we begin to see the grandsons of Esau to come to pass here. These were the names of Esau's son, Eliphaz, the son of Adah, the wife of Esau, Reuel, the son of Basmath, the wife of Esau. Two sons mentioned here, Eliphaz and Reuel, and then the sons of Eliphaz, that's the grandsons of Esau. And the sons of Eliphaz were Teman, Omar, Zepho, Gatam, and Kenaz. Teman, the first son, will have a town named after him. This is the place where one of Job's friends come from in Job 2:11. He's named as Eliphaz the Temanite. So not only is he going to have a town named after him, but one of his progeny is also going to name one of their kids after great-grandfather Eliphaz, okay? And so his name is going to be Eliphaz as well from Teman because he's a Temanite. And so verse 12 says, now Timnah was the concubine of Eliphaz, Esau's son, and she bore Amalek to Eliphaz. These were the sons of Adah, Esau's wife. So here Eliphaz takes another wife, a concubine named Timnah. They have another son. They name him Amalek, which is where the Amalekites came from. They settled in the area of the Sinai and the Negev. They were the very first to make war with Israel in Exodus 17:8-16. This is where it says the Amalekites came out to fight against Israel, you know, after they cross. After they go through the Red Sea and they're there in the wilderness, it says that the Amalekites are the ones that came to fight against them. And so Moses sends out Joshua to fight against the Amalekites. And it was in that story that, you know, when Moses is raising his hands, everything are going great and Joshua's winning. And the moment his hands get tired, he brings it down. All of a sudden, the Amalekites start winning. Aaron and Hur kind of pick up on that. And so they, you know, prop his hands up with stones underneath, and then they hold his hands up as well. So, and that's how Joshua got the victory over the Amalekites. The Amalekites were mostly the tribe that harassed Israel at the time of the judges. They're always the ones swooping down into the land, you know, and destroying their villages and pillaging and grabbing all their grain and things like that. It was the Amalekites that Saul was told to utterly destroy in 1 Samuel 14 and 15. The tribe of Simeon finally exterminated them in 1 Chronicles 4 in the days of King Hezekiah. So this is very prominent because over the next few hundred years, the Amalekites become a huge people group that caused nothing but trouble for Israel. In verse 13, it says, these were the sons of Reuel, Nahath, Zerah, Shema, and Mizah. These were the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. So these are Esau and Basemath, the fourth grandsons from their son Reuel. They get four grandkids from there. These are the sons of Aholibamah, Esau's wife, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon. She bore to Esau Yeush, Jalam, and Korah. Now, it's interesting to me that they don't give any progeny after that. And yet, you know that they married, that you know that they probably had kids, but nothing is being given of them. I would submit to you the names that are being given doesn't mean that these are all the grandsons Esau had, doesn't mean that these are all the sons that he has. These are the sons and the grandsons that were prominent in the building up of these generations of who? Edomites. Edomites, because you're going to see all these guys becoming chiefs, okay? And so these are the three sons of Esau through Aholibamah. So, and no grandsons are given here as with the other two wives, but you know that they did, but they didn't go on to bigger and better things like the other ones have. And so we have this chart here that you can see Aholibamah right there. This is, you know, where she comes from, these two guys right here. She marries Esau. Esau, you know, also has, marries Adah and Basemath. And through Aholibamah, these are the kids that they have right there. Through Basemath, this is the child they have along with these grandkids right here. And through Esau, Adah has Eliphaz, who has all these kids. But Eliphaz also married Timnah, where Amalek came from. And so just a little chart of how the Edomite kingdom began right here, okay? So Esau has five sons, could have more, but for whatever reason, they weren't prominent in making, and 10 grandsons in making the kingdom of Edom. So Reuel is Reuel, means friend of God. This is interesting to me, okay? Because I would submit to you through all this progeny here that we saw on that chart, that some worship the one true God. And he named a child means friend of God. And so that influence that Abraham has had, maybe not on Esau himself, but maybe on his grandkids when he was around them, you know, and the time they were bailed around, seeing that he was worshiping the one true God, has influenced somewhat. Interesting that Job's friend is a Temanite, comes from the town of Teman, which means Job's friend, who is a believer in the one true God, is living there in the east in the land of Edom there, and he's a believer in God. So again, I make reference to this because all along the way, I've always been saying God has his ambassadors in places, and we're not even told about them in God's word. Okay, he's doing something there. What about this country over here that doesn't know God? How do you know they don't know God? Well, nobody has been there for years. We don't have mission. Well, you don't know what God is doing there. And Job is a perfect example of this Temanite coming to minister to him because he's a worshiper of the one true God. And is coming from the east, which is the area of Edom, is where he's coming from. And so here in verse 15, it says, these were the chiefs of the sons of Esau, the sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, were chief Teman, chief Omar, chief Zepho, chief Kenaz, chief Korah. You should circle that. We'll come back to that. Chief Gatam, chief Amalek. These were the chiefs of Eliphaz in the land of Edom. They were the sons of Adah. These were the sons of Reuel, Esau's son, chief Nahath, chief Zerah, chief Shema, chief Mizah. These were the chiefs of Reuel in the land of Edom. These were the sons of Basemath, Esau's wife. These were the sons of Aholibamah, Esau's wife, chief Yeush, and chief Jalam, and chief Korah. These were the chiefs who descended from Aholibamah, Esau's wife, the daughter of Anah. And these were the sons of Esau, who is Edom, and these were their chiefs. The word chief in the Hebrew is aluf. It means duke. All the sons and grandsons of Esau, they became chiefs or dukes or captains is what they became, military commanders most likely. But you'll notice we have an extra Korah here. the sons of Eliphaz, but we have not read about Korah being a son of Eliphaz. And so, again, when you look things up and you try and figure out where this is coming from, it never ceases to amaze me how these supposedly scholars will say something like, well, it was just a mistake, it was a misprint, you know, that some, it's a scribal error that somebody threw down there. Is it? Or is it possible that when Moses was led by the Holy Spirit to write what he wrote there, he wrote Korah because Korah was also another son of Eliphaz, but maybe this son also came from a concubine, but a different concubine, and the reason why that concubine isn't named is because this one doesn't create a people group that rises to prominence like Amalek does. And so instead just kind of throws in there, hey, guess what? Oh yeah, there was another son here of Eliphaz, Korah, who also ended up becoming a chief. Yeah, I think that's hugely possible. I think that's hugely possible. You know, the reason why, again, you don't mention, but Korah is mentioned here because he became one of the chiefs from the line of Esau. There could be other sons. There could be other grandsons. And they're not as significant in the establishment of Edom, and so they're not being mentioned. But this one is being mentioned because this one is someone who becomes a chief. But then later on, you know, their kids or that progeny doesn't become its own people group like Amalek is. And that could have been from a different wife as well, just like with Timnah. So we have a total of 14 chiefs here. Again, the word chief here are sons, grandsons that became chiefs, the duke, military commanders. This would indicate how they grew as a nation. It would be by military conquest. It's exactly what Isaac prophesied about Esau. When Esau was crying after Jacob had stole his blessing, don't you have a blessing for me, Father? Certainly you have another blessing for me. And we read in Genesis 27, verse 39, and this is what Isaac prays over and blesses him with this prayer. He says, then Isaac, his father, answered and said to him, behold, your dwelling shall be the fatness of the earth and of the dew of heaven from above. But with him, he said, by your sword you shall live. Speaks of military conquest. Isn't it interesting that he is dividing his clansmen and everything else into tribes and military chiefs and things like that? And you shall serve your brother, and it shall come to pass when you become restless, you shall break his yoke from your neck. And so Esau will be living by military conquest. It's Esau's descendants who would become one of Israel's greatest enemies. 500 years after Esau, Moses, when leading Israel from Egypt, the Edomites would not allow for Israel to pass through its territories to get to the promised land, Numbers chapter 20. When Saul became king, he had to fight the Edomites, 1 Samuel 14. David subdued the Edomites, thus the older would serve the younger, thus speaking of Jacob and their descendants. One of the most infamous offenses took place during Israel's deportation to Babylon, and that is when the Edomites blocked the crossroads and cut off the escape routes for the Jew, thus delivering up to the Babylonians for exile. The entire book of Obadiah is written about the coming judgment against the Edomites because of those things and those atrocities and the way that they've treated their brother Israel. Tragically, it was an Edomite king. Herod the Great was half Jew, half Edomite. He's the one that exterminated the babies of Bethlehem in an attempt to kill the King of Kings in Matthew 2. Herod the Great was the ultimate son of Esau, and Jesus became the ultimate son of Jacob. This testifies the significance of choices in life and the path we choose. There's always a ripple effect, always. And so now we see where the Edomites have come from through the line of Esau. And now we're going to see here the descendants of Seir from Seir the Horite. In verse 20, it says, these were the sons of Seir the Horite who inhabited the land. Here are the original inhabitants of the land that when Esau went, he dispossessed them. And then they intermarried with him. Okay? And so the Horites lived at Mount Seir before it was called Edom. Horite, the word Horite is Horay, it means cave dweller, is what that means. That means that they lived in caves found in the mountain range of Mount Seir. In secular history, they're known as the Hurrians, as mentioned in the Nuzi tablets. Moses tells us in Deuteronomy 2:12, the Horites formerly dwelt in Seir, but the descendants of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and dwelt in their place, just as Israel did to the land of their possession, which the Lord gave them. So obviously went into the land. There were some military conflicts that went on. Esau and his descendants won, subjugated them, intermarried with them, and now the Horites became absorbed into Edom. Okay, came absorbed into them. Verse 20 of 36 says, these were the sons of Seir, the Horite, who inhabited the land. Lotan, Shobal, Zibeon, Anah, Dishon, later on came out with a great mustard. Just saying. Ezer, Dishan, these were the chiefs of the Horites, the sons of Seir in the land of Edom. Now we get the list of Horite grandsons. The sons of Lotan were Horai, Heman. Lotan's sister was Timnah. We've already seen that Timnah was mentioned as a concubine to Esau's sons, Eliphaz. Okay. Verse 23, these are the sons of Shobal, Alvin. There's a chipmunk joke in there somewhere. Manahath, Ebal, Shepho, Onam. These were the sons of Zibeon, both Asia and Anna. This was the Anna that who found water in the wilderness as he pastured the donkeys of his father Zibeon. Why? Why give us that information? You know, it's not as though you're going through this and go, man, I hope I find the answer to who found the water there in the wilderness. But that's what's given here. Oh, good. I was wondering who found the water in the wilderness, he said sarcastically. But it's obviously significant. And remember, when Moses wrote this down, this could be an area there at Mount Seir that has a spring of water somewhere that allows for the watering of sheep and oxen and herds and things like that. And if you didn't know about it, you wouldn't be able to do that. And that there was somebody who found this wellspring of water, and it really was important to them at this time. And now they know who it was that did that, okay? They know who did that. And these were the children of Anah, Dishon and Aholibamah, the daughter of Anah. Aholibamah became the wife of Esau, one of the wives of Esau. These were the sons of Dishon is Hemdan, Eshban, Ithran, and Sharan, and these were the sons of Ezer, Bilhan, Zavah, and Achan. And these were the sons of Dishan, Uz, and Aran. Okay? And so now, of all the people that we've just mentioned here, who were the chiefs? The very first ones that were mentioned in verse 20 here. These were the chiefs of the Horites. Chief Lotan, Chief Shobal, Chief Zibeon, Chief Anah. Very interesting. Very, very interesting. Chief Dishon, and Chief Ezer, and Chief Dishan. These were the chiefs of the Horites, according to their chiefs in the land of Seir. So now you have the chiefs that descended from Esau. You have the chiefs that descend from Seir the Horite. At this point, probably what is going on is the fact that the Horites are already in subjection to the Edomites, the descendants of Esau. Now, we have this chart right here too, just so you could see all the guys that came from Seir. Okay, here are his sons right here. Here are the sons that they had, all the grandsons, all that kind of stuff. These are all the people that we just mentioned and where they came from. Okay, so that's a pretty good clan in and of itself, okay? But these are all Horites, okay? These are not descendants from Esau. These are all Horites, all right? So, according to Dr. Arnold Fruchtenbaum, it would seem that eventually these chiefs or clan leaders or military leaders would elect a king. Kingship was not dynastic. So as we're about to list some kings here, you'll notice that the next king isn't their son. So it's not a father-son relationship in the way of kingship. Instead, Edom would always select a king. They had an actual elected monarchy. When a king died, the leaders or chiefs got together and elected the next king. This is the reason why not a king followed his father in the list of kings. And the capital of Edom at any time was always the hometown of the elected king. There was no capital of Edom. The capital would be whoever was king in that area. Okay, that became the capital. So we have 8 elected kings that have come from Edom all the way up the time Moses wrote this. So now these were the kings who reigned in the land of Edom before any king reigned over the children of Israel. Verse 31. Here's the first king. Verse 32. Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinahaba. When Bela died, Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozra, reigned in his place. Who's Jobab? I would submit to you that's Job. Now, we're going to start off with this next time. We're going to talk a little bit about this because I've only done a kiddie pool dive into this. I want to do a deeper dive. But as of today, if you were to ask me, Dave, what do you think? Right now, I think it's kind of leading to the fact that this is Job. Next time, I might say, ain't Job. Here's the reason why. But from my kiddie pool dive so far, I submit to you it could possibly be Job. That's how sure I am. So we'll come back to this, okay? When Jobab died, Husham of the land of the Temanites reigned in his place. And when Husham died, Hadad, the son of Bedad, well, of course Hadad was the son of Bedad, who attacked Midian in the field of Moab, reigned in his place, and the name of the city was Avith. Now, here we have the exploits of someone. No doubt it was that great exploit that probably made him king of Edom. Okay, he attacked Midian in the field of Moab, which must have been a very brave act. He must have been victorious, or why mention it? You're not going to elect some loser that loses battles. So he most likely won that battle. It was a great victory, very brave act. And so because of that, it seems to be that's why he became king. All right. When Hadad died, Samlah of Masrekah reigned in his place. And when Samlah died, Saul of Rehoboth by the river reigned in his place. Interesting that the Edomites had a king named Saul before Israel had a king named Saul. That's all it got. I just thought it was interesting. I know you think, ooh, this might go deeper. It doesn't. That's it. Verse 38, when Saul died, Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, reigned in his place. And by the way, as I always say, feel free to go home and mispronounce these on your own. Okay, I have no idea if that's actually how it's pronounced. Achbor. And when Baal-Hanan, the son of Achbor, died, Hadar reigned in his place, and the name of his city was Pa. And his wife's name was Mehetabel, the daughter of Matred, the daughter of Mezahab. Don't know why they're mentioned. But I would submit to you there's a line there that is probably important to them. And that is why it's mentioned. And so Moses ends with this King Hadar, which then leads me to believe that this was probably the king that was alive when Moses wrote this. Because there's other kings that come after this. But when Moses is writing this, this is the king that would be there at that time that he's writing this. This would be the king that's in power at this time. And the reason I think this is significant is because we're not told in Numbers chapter 20 who this king of Edom is that says no to Israel crossing their land. But I would submit to you it's probably Hadar here. Because at the time he wrote this, that's who the king was. So in Numbers chapter 20, verse 14, when we read, "Now Moses sent messengers from Kadesh to the king of Edom, and thus says your brother Israel, you know all the hardship that has befallen us, how our fathers went down to Egypt. We dwelt in Egypt a long time, and the Egyptians afflicted us and our fathers. And we cried out to the Lord. He heard our voice and sent an angel, brought us out of Egypt. Now here we are in Kadesh, a city on the edge of your border. Please let us pass through your country. We will not pass through the fields or the vineyards, nor will we drink water from the wells. We will go along the king's highway. We will not turn aside to the right hand or to the left until we have passed through your territory." And the Edom said to him, "You shall not pass through my land lest I come against you with the sword." No, the big N-O, you can't. Okay? Interesting. And so I would submit to you that that's probably King Hadar that said no here. It's interesting to me as we see all these kings that it seems to me that Esau and what he was able to build was quicker and seemed to be greater at this time than what God was doing through Jacob. God was doing through Jacob. I would submit to you that there are quicker ways to build a kingdom. And I would submit to you there's quicker ways to build a fellowship, a church. And I would submit to you there's quicker ways to build a physical building of a church, hence our church property. They're all quicker ways, you know. But when I look at who Esau was, he's a man of the moment. Can't seem to think about the future. This is what he wants now. Man of action. He's guided by his pleasures, his desires. He wants immediate gratification. However, that never leads to ultimate satisfaction. Say this to young people all the time. Delayed gratification will lead to ultimate satisfaction. And you try and impart that to people. And yet, it saddens me when I have to impart that to people that aren't young. Your whole life, this is what you've done. And this is why it is the way it is. Don't do this thing that you feel like is going to be a good move. It won't. You're trying to satisfy something that only comes when you put it in the hands of the Lord, and you're going after an immediate gratification, it will not satisfy. As Joey and I like to say, it's a short-term hit for a long-term gain. But people want that short-term gain, but what comes with it is a long-term hit, and it won't satisfy. It won't satisfy. Pleasure, immediate gratification is all Esau could see. That's why he despised his birthright, despises heritage by marrying pagan women. Esau's short-sightedness is what put him before this tragic course for himself and his descendants. For every generation, the challenge is the same. We need to see that there's more to life than what is right in front of us. There's more to life than pleasure, indulgences, and that we're to set our minds on things above. The eternal things, the inheritance that's coming, that will be filled with more satisfaction than the world could ever offer. Don't sell yourself short by going after the things that are temporary, the things that don't satisfy. Yet this is what we have always been tempted with from the very beginning. You have Adam and Eve. Hey, just tend the garden. Love God, tend the garden. You know, enjoy being married with one another. Just walk with God. And what happens? Satan swoops in there and goes, he's withholding from you. He says, don't eat of this tree, but look how nice and wonderful the fruit is. All you have to do right now, just take a bite. Right now, you will become like God. Immediate gratification. Right there. It's right there. This could all be over. You could be just like God. You don't have to walk with him. You don't have to do what he says to do. You don't have to do all these things that he wants you to do. Just eat right now. Just take a bite. And they do. And the long-term ramifications of that, not good. Not good at all. Lot fixed his eyes on Sodom. Look how green and lush it is. Ooh, look how pretty. He ended up losing his family, lost everything. Abraham believed God, and his generations continued. Jesus was commissioned by God to redeem back all of mankind, the earth itself. Satan comes along to tempt him. Hey, look, I own all these kingdoms here. If you just bow down to worship me, I'll give it to you right now. You're not going to have to wait and be rejected, continue to be rejected by your own kind, and then get beaten to a pulp and then have to be on a cross for 6 hours, then die and rise again and then go up in heaven and wait how many thousands of years before you come back and take control of the earth. I'll just give it to you right now. Wow. One is a whole lot more longer. The other one, just do that right now. But then where would we be if he did that? Wow. In Psalm 17, we read this, "With your hand from men, O Lord, from the men of the world who have their portion in this life, whose belly you will fill with your hidden treasure, they are satisfied with children and leave the rest of their possession for their babes. As for me, I will see your face in righteousness. I shall be satisfied when I awake in your likeness." I love that. Yeah, there's other men here that are going after the hidden treasures that are here in this world, but you know what I'm going to be satisfied with? Seeing you in righteousness. I'm going to be satisfied with that. Seeing you in righteousness. Awaking in your likeness. Yeah, I'm going to die. And just like it says in 1 John, that when we see him, we are going to be like him. You know? Interesting. One commentary I read said this, note this, "The children of this world have their all in hand and nothing in hope, while the children of God have their all in hope, next to nothing in hand. But all things considered, it is better to have Canaan in the promise than Mount Seir in possession." I love that. This is what I'm going to share with my pastor friend this afternoon when I go and see him. Your promise of seeing your son again is still far off, you know, but you are going to see him again. I would rather have dead believing children in heaven than the possession of all my children here with them not knowing the Lord. That's what's being said there. That's what's being said there. Those who put their hopes in the things of this world, this is as good as it's going to get. Those who put their hope in the Lord, the world is as bad as it's going to get. Psalm 31:24 says, "Be of good courage, and he shall strengthen your heart, all you who hope in the Lord." Psalm 37:9 says, "For evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth." Psalm 37:34, "Wait on the Lord and keep his way. He shall exalt you to inherit the land. When the wicked are cut off, you shall see it." That's the verse God gave me like about 5 years ago when it came to our property. And even though I wasn't saying it, it was in my heart, and God knew that. Hey, when are we going to be able to build on that? Hey, when are we going to be able to have that property up there and actually have it as a church? And when are we? And he gave me that. Just wait on the Lord. And if he should tarry, you'll inherit the land. It will happen. If he doesn't come back tomorrow, if he doesn't come back in the next year and a half or 2 years, whatever, Lord willing, we'll be up there, you know? And that's why, you know, there's different ways to build a church. And we didn't have any campaign. We didn't take pledges from you. We didn't have any thermometer up here. Going, you know, you're kind of down this week. What's wrong with you? Aren't you Christians? Da, da, da. You need to give more. Blah, blah, blah. We got to get up to this point. We didn't do any of that. None of this rah-rah stuff to give more. Anything. No. God's going to put on your heart what to give. And I don't have to worry about that. That's between you and God. And God owns the cattle on 1,000 hills. And if we need more money, guess what? He will raise that money up. The bills that come in here, guess what? Those are God's bills. They're not mine. And I love the way that how God balances checkbook. It's just really cool to be able to see. I get to see that. And the board gets to see that. And we get to see how God blesses. And it's awesome. We are so over budget right now with that project. But you know what? That's God's problem. It's not because of our lack of stewardship. It's because prices have gone through the roof. All right. That's a God problem. That's not a my problem. So I just pray. And then I see God bring money in amazing ways. And I'm just going, this is so cool. Because it's his. Yeah, there's different ways to do it. There's quicker ways to get into things. But that's us manipulating. That's us going for gratification, not for satisfaction. Wait. Wait on the Lord. And guess what? Isaiah 40, verse 31. But those who wait on the Lord shall renew their strength. They shall mount out with the wings like eagles. They shall run and not be weary. They shall walk and not faint. Amen? Let's pray.